Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Chuck Thurston, Marvin Garin, and Andre Rodatis. Hi, guys. We're all here.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. How nice. It's good to hear your voices today. Yay.
Likewise.
Well,
Happy New Year.
Yeah, everybody. Yes, Happy
New Year.
We're a couple weeks in now. I won't make any comment on 2022, but yeah, it was a great year for the Cosmic Citizen. We did a lot of wonderful studies, and I hope, you know, it's been suggested that we do the first five papers of the Urantia book because we've never done that before, and I didn't realize that. And those papers are so amazing and important, so I'm happy to do that. And, when we mentioned it on air, I think our good friend Robert on the board said, "Wow, what a great way to start the new year." So I'm all for that. Did everybody have a good holiday season? Marvin, I know you've been a little under the weather. Are you feeling better?
Yeah. Still last tail end of the mending process, but I think feeling better, yeah. Through much of the holiday, just the cough, cold thing.
Okay.
It's been going around.
It's been going around for sure.
Yes, it has.
Yeah. I'm going to have questions up on the Mansion Worlds with about, you know, all these viruses and just the human condition physiologically and how it's been affected by the Adamic default primarily. You know, I wonder how much impact that is in comparison to normal worlds. I guess we'll find out.
Yeah. I'm sure, and we'll all have lots of questions about it, I'm sure.
Yeah, how are you guys doing? How was your holiday?
Mine was great. I got to spend time with family, and I know you did too, Andre. And I got to spend time with family and
even
friends,
got to spend
and nothing
time
could
with
be
you.
Better.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
That's right.
It was great.
Yeah, nice. We did too.
Afternoon at your house, Paula.
Yeah, it was nice. I was so glad that you guys were able to come, and it was really wonderful to see you all and spend time with you.
Yeah, it's great to have a little in-person social time.
Yeah.
Rarely these days.
I know. Really is.
You got to enjoy your tree, too. Your wonderful tree.
That was so sweet, Chuck. I mean, you know, I told you a little bit about the history of that tree and how it's cathartic for me to put it up, because I've collected those ornaments, and it was kind of a tradition that was passed on to me by a very good friend who was instrumental in my life. She was one of the first people that I'd say after I left the nest became like a mentor to me. She was 56 and I was 18. And I really needed a friend, because I moved to Pueblo to be close to my first husband. I didn't have any friends there. I didn't know anybody. And I went to work, and she worked there as well. She worked at the same place, and she took me under her wing. And it was a wonderful, wonderful friendship. And she had this most beautiful Christmas tree, and she went through great pains, and she told me all about how she collected these ornaments from all over the world, and how people and places she had gone, and how people had given her these ornaments. And every year, you know, she put it up with such great care, and every year she took it down with equal care. And I helped her take it down one year. I was so impressed. And when she left it to me in her will. And so many of the ornaments on that tree were ornaments that she gave me. And it's so meaningful to put them up. Some of them have been broken. You just, ornaments are fragile, you know. And but I still have many of the ones she gave me, and I've also gone on to collect many of my own. So everywhere I go, you know, when I went to Africa for the parliament, I made it a point to get ornaments from Africa. And so whenever I put up my tree, it's a walk down memory lane for me. But I found out recently from my son that my daughter-in-law was razzing him because he doesn't help her put up the tree. And he said, no, I just want to watch you put it up, because I don't want to be involved in anything where I put up an ornament and it gets moved. And I go, I know, that's probably my fault. And he just laughed.
It all placed somewhere and then you moved it.
Yeah.
Well,
too much of a perfectionist.
Well, it was definitely a composition, you know. Like most people just hang ornaments, but in your case, it's a work of art.
Yeah.
So, I hope you got the one picture I sent you. I could send you.
I did. I loved it. Thank you.
Yeah,
it was beautiful. To have an artist like you take pictures of it was really the greatest compliment. So, anyway, it's a tradition. Traditions are beautiful if they're meaningful, you know, I think that's
right,
the
exactly.
thing.
Yeah. Get out what you put in.
Yeah, you get out what you put in, for sure. So, well, thanks. That was that was nice to have you guys over and have a small gathering. It was really special. You know, we just haven't done that in our community. Wow, COVID changed many, many things. For all of us, so.
Oh yeah.
And I reflect on that quite a bit, you know. I also reflect on how, you know, we've kind of gotten to this place now where these variants are going around, and we're going, well, you know, there's fatigue.
Yes. Yeah, there is.
So maybe,
and it's unfortunate both ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, you end up having people getting sick unnecessarily, and on the one hand, and you've got people that are, you know, just not concerned on the one hand, or just caring too much about it, you know.
Right. All things in between.
More on the other side, really. And so we've got this thing, it's in perpetuity now, and it didn't have to be, but this is not like what we did with smallpox and tried to eradicate it. Instead, we just ignored it for a while and made sure that it would be a going concern. So here we are.
I think they call that an endemic. It's reached that level where
it's now
an endemic.
Yeah, it's like the flu now. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not the flu, and we never know just how it's going to mutate or what's going to happen with it. Or we'll see what happens. Anyway.
But, you know, we're resilient
talk about
creatures,
mid-waves.
Aren't we? I know.
Yeah, we're doing midwares today.
I've been reflecting on this paper because we're at the last section now, and just what a gift these angels are to us from our mother. Well, I don't know why that didn't fully hit me before, but how up close and personal she comes to us through their ministry. And how beautiful they are, and how much, you know, anybody who believes in angels, who has faith, and most of us probably believed in them before we even read the Urantia book, or at least wondered about them, you know? And then comes this revelation that tells us so much about the angels and how they serve us and their ministry to us, and then we find out that they're a gift to us from our creative mother spirit. And they are her gift. It's her ministry.
The whole seraphic enterprise, along with the cherubim and sanabim, is all about the mortal ascension scheme. That whole enterprise, it's all about moving us forward. That's fully at least a seventh of the local universe angelic creation. And you can imagine that recapitulated up top, you know, with coordinates of the Sakhanafim and coordinates of the Sapernafim. But my goodness, we don't realize how many things have been done in order to get this enterprise of moving an animal origin being who is capable of conceiving of God from the very bottom of personal existence to the top, to the presence of God himself. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, well, I was just going to mention, too, that they gift themselves also. It's in their nature to be ministering spirits. So ministry is of the nature of the third source and center, which we experience directly through these daughters, ultimately, of the infinite spirit, through the mother spirit, and that they have that in their nature inherently seems to be this spirit of gifting. Like they just give themselves whatever assignment they have, and they thrill to be able to minister, especially on the lowest levels. You know, that's what's one of the interesting things that we learned about, is that they crave assignment to the lowest level of life, which would be us, you know, ascending life. You know, thinking of ourselves as ascending sons, and they just, you know, crave to be there and help us because, well, part of it is that they ascend with us. You know, that's one of the things we learned, which is fascinating, that we have this partnership or collaboration going forward into eternity where we help each other make it to the center. They depend on us and we depend on them. So it's a beautiful kind of bonding, I'm sure, that we'll experience, even though our paths may divert a little bit toward the end. What's their goal? The seraphic, something seraphic completion, something like that? Anyway,
the core of seraphic completion, yeah.
Right, exactly. So their goal is a little different from ours, but we'll, in some cases, rejoin, I think. And we're certainly going to be bonded for eternity. You know, the pair of angels that end up being our guardians going forward from this life. Quite a relationship we're going to have.
Imagine
especially
that.
When we can see them, you know. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
It's going to be something.
Do you ever contemplate, I mean, like, I many times ask them for things and, you know, ask for their help because I know they're immediate, they're right here, you know. I contemplate them a lot, and I try to express to them how grateful I am, and I often feel their love.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just... You know, we worship God, but there's no reason why we can't already have a relationship with our unseen friends, I think. You know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I think one of the qualities of the ascendant, of the whole ascendant experience is you've got these very, very different kinds of beings sourcing from different places in the deity nature. You know, these third source wonderful sisters. And we're really pretty different than them, and we're similar in some ways, but we're pretty different from them in nature. And the adventure of working together, serving together, being companions together for such a long, long period of time proliferates all this different kinds of experiences that I think we can have with these different kinds of beings along a common journey. And that seems to be thematic here. And so it's really quite remarkable to read these papers where they describe in such detail these angels, different orders of angels, and how we'll spend time with them, how we'll serve with them, work with them, and the joy of the friendship we'll have with them. Sort of the theme is a common journey. For me, the theme is a common journey, but because of our differences in nature and approach and temperament, just the proliferation and hybridization of all different kinds of experiences we'll have together. And it was, particularly interesting. I just looked over briefly this last section of the Midwares, and they are really an amazing group of beings, a very small group of beings compared to our numbers. But all of these angels, the cherubim, the seraphim, the higher angels. They're just pretty amazing, the diversity in what we'll get to experience with them together. It's really been a great paper to read.
Do you think that knowing what they do, as your Rancher book spells out in so many ways, this is just one example, this paper, there's so much more about the angels. They talk about them at length, and you know, they're mentioned probably they're throughout the book, the different levels and how they serve and what they do. I have found, and I'll throw this out there to you guys, that it really helps me to know how they work. Because then I feel like I can be more helpful to them. So, and I'll give you an example. Whenever we would go to do an expo where we, you know, exhibit the Urantia book in public and mostly New Age shows, events, which is great because they New Agers typically do have a strong faith in the unseen realm. You know, they have a strong faith in ascended masters and angels and other, you know, unseen friends. And but we would always pray before we started that the angels would guide whatever hungry souls were coming to that show. If they needed what we had to offer, that they would guide them to us, knowing full well that they do things like that. And it's all, and that knowledge actually comes from the Urantia book. That's not something I understood prior to reading the Urantia book. I never understood that. You know, that angels bring people together. It's like the, you know.
Social architects.
Yeah, the social architects, exactly.
Yeah, that they work in the social, they work in the social arena, the social environment between people and amongst people.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, promises I've made to them to be helpful to those that they bring in to help me understand who they've brought to me, you know. I mean, it's enriched my relationship with them so much to understand. They just, they're basic, their work, you know, what they do,
mm-hmm.
you know, especially the guardians, but we know that there's more than just guardians, and they do so
yeah.
much more than that. Not to make light of their wonderful efforts, because you're right, we'll go through eternity with them, and it'll be a constant relationship. You know, most relationships, I mean, even as we know, you know, we'll be on different assignments. We may not see someone for many thousands of years. And then we'll see them again. But the angels were with, pretty much, for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
Constant.
Yeah. Definitely.
I wonder, you know, I wonder a little bit, you're going to talk about the booth experience. I wonder how much of our communication with each other is being enhanced or supplemented or helped by the work of the angels. Because, I mean, if like when we're talking to each other now, we each have, you know, angels that are working with us, and they know what's in our minds.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder every now and then how much of the way we communicate and our senses of intuition as to what might be helpful in the conversation are being helped by the angels. I'll bet a fair bit, you know, in those booth conversations where you get an inspiration or inclination to explore a certain area with someone, and you wonder whether you're not getting help from their angels and our angels working together and helping us have that sense of understanding or intuition. Because all of that's mind circuitry,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Well, then
and
also,
how that works with...
There's also... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Jack.
Well, I was just going to add, just to add to that, there's also a gesture participation in that.
Right.
And
I
they
was
talk
just
about how the angels and the adjusters work together in some mysterious
right.
way that they can't actually see how it happens, but they definitely see that it does happen. That there's some kind of coordinated influence going on between seraphim and the adjusters, which
mm-hmm.
could very much facilitate kind of what you're talking about, Marvin, I think. It's like we get an intuition from the outside and they reinforce from the inside, and they kind of reinforce it from the outside somehow. I don't really know. The mechanisms are kind of inscrutable, but we definitely see and feel the results sometimes in those kind of contacts with people. You know,
but
the
certainly
the conversation goes and all of that.
They're nurturing that seed because that is it. That seed that is planted in our soul, our mind, when we're small, that becomes our soul, is the seed they're nurturing. So that relationship between the thought adjuster growing within each of us and them has to be an amazing relationship, and that will go on too. And their goal is to get you to fuse with that, right? So they're going to do anything
mm-hmm.
they can to facilitate that, to help that. And they, of course, they would work together. It just makes perfect sense to me that they
yeah.
would,
yeah,
you
absolutely.
Know, because they're reaching the same goal. They're striving for the same great goal, and that is fusion, eternity.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
it's amazing to think about.
There's a kind of a sweet comment in paper 47 that I just came across recently. It seems relevant to this, what we're talking about our relationship with the angels. And this is from section 7. They're just talking about the different mansion worlds and what goes on on the different mansion worlds. But I think this is maybe about the 6th mansion world. But the last paragraph of that section, paragraph 5, embedded in it is this wonderful little comment. And this is when we get to the 5th mansion world. Keep this in mind. Where they say that it is beginning to dawn upon the enlarging minds of the ascending mortals that some stupendous and magnificent, some supernal and divine destiny awaits all who complete the progressive paradise ascension, which has been so laboriously but so joyfully and auspiciously begun. About then, and then they say, at about this point, the average mortal ascender begins to manifest a bona fide experiential enthusiasm for the Havona ascent. Study is becoming voluntary, unselfish service natural, and worship spontaneous. A real Marantxa character is budding. A real Marantxa creature is evolving. Wow. So this would be one of the goals of the angels, you know, to get us to this point where life is no longer a chore, but we're beginning to manifest bona fide experiential enthusiasm. I don't know. It's just funny how they put these ideas into words. But the thing about and how it begins to dawn on us by the fifth
on
mansion,
the fifth mansion.
Right. There's some crazy thing awaiting us, you know, some supernal and divine destiny, something stupendous and magnificent.
Well,
I don't know.
We know that highly evolved mortals can reach that same place because it starts to happen
well, yeah,
in enlightened life and those worlds. And
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
it just takes time, I think.
Right.
It's amazing. Well, I just want to tell everybody, for some reason I can't chat today. That it just ain't working for me. It's not giving me the prompt. So it's not that I'm ignoring you guys on the chat board. I just, I can't chat for some reason. So.
And unfortunately, I have a trackpad problem that is causing me problems as well. So my chats will be limited and maybe garbled and maybe completely inappropriate for all I know because of how my trackpad is picking things that I don't intend to pick. So I'm just avoiding it for right now.
Okay, so sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry, friends.
Monday.
Sorry, Perry, Gina, Bob. It's good to see you guys on the board.
It is.
Love to chat with you always, but for some reason today it's just not functioning. You know, such is the internet in my experience, you know. I'm always grateful when everything works well. And when it doesn't, I'm like, well, our dear friend John Hales used to tell me, gremlins.
The gremlins.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Gremlins get in the machinery sometimes. I don't know how that happens, but
gremlin alert.
Yeah, gremlin alert. But we are on section 9, the midway creatures. And this is, you know, the midwayers are a fascination to me. Always have been. I'm just, and the book says so many things, so much about the midwayers. This is just one section on the midwayers. There's so much on the midwayers throughout the book. And, of course, we know that they are the wonderful authors of part 4. So I hope that, you know, I don't know, Chuck, sometimes you have a really good relevant preamble to the section we're about to read that explains a little bit more about the midway creatures, but, and I don't know if you have something like this for this or if
no.
we should just jump in
well, this is,
and
we
read this.
Because there's a whole big section on the midwayers later on in paper 77, but this is the preamble.
Okay. So this is
that.
Right. But you know, what is interesting about this is that midway creatures are a little different from seraphim. Their origin is different. The nature is different in some ways. But they're included in this paper about ministering spirits because they do minister to us. So we'll still talk about that as we get into this section. But I think it's interesting that they're included in this paper. I wouldn't necessarily expected that because technically they're not angels. I mean, they're not seraphim. They're a different order of being. But they serve alongside the angels. And they
quite a hybrid, you know.
Right.
In their nature. Yeah, we'll read about that. Yeah.
And the two different types have very different origins.
Okay.
Yeah.
Marvin, do you want to
go ahead?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'll take it. This is section 9 from paper 38, the midway creatures. The midway creatures.
We may want to
split,
split it up long
up?
Enough. Yeah, we may want to pause somewhere in there, Paula. That's all.
Okay.
Whatever you want to do. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I'll see if there's a stopping point. I'll stop, and then someone else can pick it up. The midway creatures have a threefold classification. They're properly classified with the ascending sons of God. They are factually grouped with the orders of permanent citizenship, while they are functionally reckoned with the ministering spirits of time because of their intimate and effective association with the angelic hosts in the work of serving mortal man on the individual worlds of space. These unique creatures appear on the majority of the inhabited worlds and are always found on the decimal or life experiment planets, such as Urantia. Midwayers are of two types, primary and secondary, and they appear by the following techniques. 1. Primary midwayers, the more spiritual group, are a somewhat standardized order of beings who are uniformly derived from the modified ascendant mortal staffs of the planetary princes. The number of primary midway creatures is always 50,000, and no planet enjoying their ministry has a larger group. 2. Secondary midwayers. The more material group of these creatures vary greatly in numbers on the different worlds, though the average is around 50,000. They are variously derived from the planetary biologic uplifters, the Adams and Eves, or from their immediate progeny. There are no less than 24 diverse techniques involved in the production of these secondary midway creatures on the evolutionary worlds of space. The mode of origin for this group on Urantia was unusual and extraordinary. Neither of these groups is an evolutionary accident. Both are essential features in the predetermined plans of the universe architects, and their appearance on the evolving worlds at the opportune juncture is in accordance with the original designs and developmental plans of the supervising life carriers. We can stop there. That's in itself so much interesting information they're giving us here. The first thing that struck me about that is that they happen always on experimental worlds. Why do you suppose that is? Always experimental planets or decimal. Was it decimal? Decimant. My tongue is getting in my way today.
It's the same thing, found on the decimal or life experiment planet. So the decimal are, they are the life experiment planets.
Yes.
Yeah,
it's the same thing, right.
Well, you know, there is a lot in here, you know, in quite a bit of detail. One was, I'm not finding it now. Oh, yeah, these unique creatures appear on the majority of the inhabited worlds. So that's interesting. That means that some worlds, they don't appear.
Right.
But it's the large majority. So that's kind of interesting. And and I was really caught by the information in the first paragraph where they're sort of, they have this hybrid nature. You know, they're ascending sons of God, like we are. And it's interesting, they're classified sons of God and not daughters of God, even though...
Right. To Chuck's point earlier, or somebody said it. They're not really angels.
So they're classified as sons of God, ascending sons, and they do end up in the core of finality along with us in limited numbers. And yet they function, their factually grouped as orders of permanent citizenship. So while they're ascending, they spend a tremendous amount of time here on the planet. And I think they outlast even their parents, who were the corporeal staff, right? I think they leave earlier than the primary midwares. And yet they're functionally reckoned as ministering spirits. So they sort of bridge all these different categories. It's really very interesting, and they work very intimately with the angels. They're just really quite a unique combination of qualities. So I was just struck by that.
Well, the fact that they earlier.
Go ahead, Chuck.
I was just going to throw in that we read earlier that about the cherubim, the fourth creatures, you know, of the Marantia cherubim, the Sanubim, they are quasi-material and work closely with the secondary midwares. I think that was in the previous section. So that's an interesting connection there, too.
Larry Mullins, who once said, the angels are a living ladder of beings, of living beings, right? And you can ascend all over. They're at every level. And this is the one closest to us, closest to the material level. So, and it's interesting. I don't know if it says it in this section, but they do mention that the secondaries minister closely to us and the primaries minister more closely to the angels of the realm. Who are serving in the realm. And do you remember offhand how many were lost, how many primary midwares were lost in the rebellion?
Yeah, over 40,000.
Oh, my gosh.
9,881 loyal
and only
primaries remaining and 1,111 loyal secondaries remaining.
Wow, that's
for a total of 10,992.
Out of potentially 100,000.
Yeah.
No. 50,000 plus the 2,184, I believe, that we had before.
Oh, but I thought they were saying that it's 50,000 of the primary.
1984,
and 50, I thought it's 50,000. I thought they were saying
50,000
of each of primaries and also 50,000 secondaries.
No. Secondaries are 1,984.
No, but I mean on a normal planet, they say here in the in the fourth paragraph they say though the average of secondary midwares on a planet are 50,000. So
that may be true.
On a normal, no, that's, it says it here in this fourth paragraph, which Paula just read. They say, the more material group of these creatures vary greatly in numbers on the different worlds, though the average is around 50,000 of the secondary midwares. So, on a normal world.
But not on our world.
No.
Correct.
The Adam and Eve weren't here long enough for one reason, probably. They would have to spend their...
It finished the particular technique that was used only produced 1984.
Ah, okay. And that was an extraordinary and unusual technique, they said. Their mode of origin was unusual and extraordinary.
Every fourth child of Adamson and Rata were invisible. And those were not the midwares. Those were just their children.
That was very unusual.
And did the children
go ahead. I've interrupted
secondary...
a couple of times. Go ahead and say what you need to say.
Well, maybe you can clarify that for us, Andre. What, where did the secondary midwayers come from on Urantia?
They came from
Adamson and
Rata. Okay,
right.
Adamson was the firstborn of Adam and Eve, and Rata was an ostensibly, they don't say this definitively, but the implication is that she was one of the last remaining pure line Nodites from, you know, decamillennia before, you know, or centamillennia before. She was 25, he was 120. She had just about decided to give up even bothering to want to partner with anybody, and then she met the remarkable Adamson. They partnered, and unusually, they had something like 67 children, something similar.
You're right.
Seven. Yeah,
yeah, that's from paper 77. That's covered 77.56 is the paragraph that covers it pretty well.
And every fourth one was invisible.
Mm-hmm.
Which
sometimes,
you know, sometimes invisible. That's right. But they were clearly unusual.
Often
invisible, but what does that mean for the ones that weren't?
Right. Right.
They were still unusual
perturbed.
In some regard, or they wouldn't have mentioned, because these fourth ones, when they paired them up to mate, they started producing the secondary midwayers. And those secondary midwayers continued, I think, about every 6 months. They were able to produce them.
Yeah.
A total of almost 2,000, they said, which you said 1,900 and some, Andre, but they said almost 2,000 were created. And, you know, and here's something that just dawned on me, is that their family. These guys have the same parents. They're all one big family, these midwayers, these secondary midwayers.
Which may have limited the number, you know, that technique.
Yeah.
We don't know. Frankly, the celestial beings up to a certain level don't have any idea what's going on for that particular kind of unusual method to have worked. But in each case, each pair that was mated was done when they had produced a certain number, and I can get you that number in a moment unless you're looking at it already. But it's easy. You just divide 1984 by 8, and that's 248, I think it was, if I remember correctly, but I'll look it up.
And you're dividing by 8 because one-fourth
because there were 16 individuals and 8 pairs.
Mm-hmm.
And so that led to the, you know, A, B, C, the first, second, third, and so on. Then D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they designate those lines. All the way to the point where Terry Kruger had a wonderful parody on his, you'll remember, his satirical Urantian magazine, Urantian Sojourn, and on there he once had an interview with STU 222, Stu 222.
Stu 222.
Humor as only Terry Kruger can have it.
Yeah, right. Well, there are no wonder we're so fascinated. And you know, this occurs to me, and I'll read this paragraph if you guys don't mind, because it's so interesting. Paper 77 is a wonderful paper. It says this is 77.56. Adamson and Ratta had a family of 67 children. They gave origin to a great line of the world's leadership, but they did something more. It should be remembered that both of these beings were really superhuman. Every fourth child born to them was of a unique order. It was often invisible. Never in the world's history had such a thing occurred. Ratta was greatly perturbed, even suspicious. But Adamson, well, Oh, even, yes, yeah, superstitious, okay. But Adamson well knew of the existence of the primary midwares, and he concluded that something similar was transpiring before his eyes. When the second strangely behaving offspring arrived, he decided to mate them, since one was male and one the other female. And this is the origin of the secondary order of midwares. Within 100 years before this phenomenon ceased, almost 2,000 were brought into being. You know, this was post-rebellion, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah.
So,
oh, yeah.
So he knew, yeah, right. He knew how important this would be to us. And
yeah.
And did it.
Well, he knew something unusual might be in the works. Yeah.
Right, right. And why they would say the mode of origin for this group on your ranch was unusual and extraordinary. That makes perfect sense then.
Yeah. So I guess we can assume
because they
that...
would have been expecting secondary midwares to be arising somehow.
Somehow,
and they had not
right.
yet arisen. And, you know, as Marvin pointed out, on some planets, there's as many as 50,000, or that's an average. There could be more of the secondaries. God knows what the variable is there. But here you have a situation where 8 times 248, I believe, is the number, were produced. And why 248? Why is that the limiting number? there's nothing that special about 248 except that it's divisible by 8 and 31. You know, so put that in your pipe and smoke it. I don't know. There's 31 is an unusual number because 30 is, you know, 3 times 10, and 1 represents, you know, unity and could be leadership of that 30 or something, but you just wonder what on earth is going on, you know, in some of the numbers that they give us. But that's why we have 1,984, and a number of those rebelled, leaving 1,111 loyal secondary midwares.
Mm.
So
which is an easy number to remember,
primary.
By the way.
Yeah, 11,
the primaries
11,
are 9,811. 9,881, rather. Because the total number is 10,992. I'm sorry to be infuriating with the numbers.
You're not. I appreciate
but it.
No, it's great, Andre. Someone's
it's
got
my
to be
jam. I love
with
it.
The numbers.
Yes, it's necessary.
So, yeah. Well, that shows that the proportion of loss in the primary midwares was far greater, which is surprising, given that they're described as being quote more spiritual.
Right.
That, you know, they lost like 4/5 or more than 4/5 of the primary.
Yeah.
Right. But there's a theme that comes out, and we could discuss. It's a real tangent to go on. It's an interesting one. Maybe we don't want to go on it too far here, but there's this implication that the trying and testing that happens in mortal life and at the lower spiritual levels does something to prepare, you know, at least human beings and perhaps others, perhaps also secondary midwares for some reason. Who knows? But that having made the decision to survive and to be moral in this life is a very, very strong component of a character that beyond a certain point of development just will not rebel, just will always be loyal. And so that's something that they make, you know, when you go through the Lucifer Rebellion in paper 53, that's one of the remarkable things. How many angels fell that were on Jerusalem? You know, if you weren't there, you didn't fall. But if you were, Lucifer, it was hard for them to believe that somebody like Lucifer could go wrong. And it may have been the same way for the Midwayers in Caligastia. Just really hard to, especially the primary, remember, would have had their origin and know that it was because Caligastia was here with the 100 that they had their origin. That's almost like their father.
Yeah.
You know, there's another factor that plays in there that just occurred to me as you were talking, Andre, and that is the secondary midwares really weren't around during the outbreak and the primary eruption and effects of the rebellion. They came along way later when the results of the rebellion were very, very obvious. You know, they came into a world that was primitive and chaotic because of that rebellion, and so their experience with it was, you know, they weren't around for those first years where the primary midwares were being affected by these great debates in heaven, and they came along way later when conditions were very different.
That's a good point. They saw the results of rebellion.
So do you think that Adam and Adamson and Ratta and their progeny, their visible progeny, were able to communicate with these secondary midwares?
Say that again.
Were they, you know, they obviously came forth as a result of Adamson and Ratta, who would be, in a way, like their parents. And Adamson,
absolutely.
Yeah, their grandparents. And Adamson instructed these two to mate, right? They must have, they had to have been able to communicate with them. They were able to. And the reason I'm asking this is because those stories then that they were told about the rebellion would have been colored by what their, you know, what they had heard, what they learned. Early on from those humans that went through it.
Right. Yeah, I think they must have been able to communicate with them.
Yeah, must have been able.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, especially the
rest of their children would have been, I don't know where they would have fallen. Would they have been normal ascenders? Because they weren't unusual in that way. They probably would have been variations on normal human ascenders.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they would have been.
Yeah, normal lives and passing on to the mansion worlds.
Well, here
they may or may not.
70, in section 6 of that same paper, 77, they say, these 16 children, you know, the peculiar ones, the 16 children lived and died, except for their peculiarities, as mortals of the realm. But their electrically energized offspring live on and on, not being subject to the limitations of mortal flesh. So if the 16 lived and died as mortals, then I assume all of their children did likewise. So, but what kind of comes to my mind then, these 16, they must have been born as babies, right? Just like the others, just like their other children.
Right.
So they couldn't really mate them until they grew up to an appropriate age.
Correct.
And then eventually all the pairs that came out of that were made, you know, mated. But the secondary midwares, on the other hand, I think they just sort of came into existence fully developed. I don't think they went through the secondary midwares themselves, I don't think they went through a baby childhood progression. They just sort of came into existence fully functional.
Yeah, right. There's no
talk about,
there's no baby life for midwares. Yeah, or any other
celestial being. But there apparently was for the 16 parents.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that brings me to a comment that Bob on the board made. He said, I've often thought about how bizarre, bordering on unbelievable, to picture a woman giving birth to an invisible child. What would that look like? And, you know, that's a mystery.
Sometimes invisible. They may not have been invisible at the time of birth.
Right.
Yeah, and then to raise them. And you know, the other thought that just occurred is, these 16 were a unique group of human beings. I mean, they lived normal lives.
Yeah.
They were invisible. They gave origin to all of the secondary midwares. And they came and went, and there were no other beings that really fell into their category.
Yeah,
so what an amazing experience! What an amazing experience that would have been, you know, to be one of those 16 and not be secondary midwares, and not be normal human beings, but fulfilling this remarkable and unique service and function. Really, and they would have gone on as human ascenders, you know. So they're out there somewhere in the ascension regime, moving forward with the rest of their mortal fellows.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
but their children
too,
are here.
That what a rare individual Rata was.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that mating with her and Adamson is what produced these midwares. So I mean, what a thin strand of possibility was maintained up until that point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if Rata hadn't existed as a pure line nodite, this wouldn't have been possible. Mm-hmm. And what did they say about her? She just about decided not to mate. Okay, we're done. And then Adamson showed up. Whoa. Maybe I'll reconsider.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
I think there's lore about them in the Vedic scriptures, actually, too, which is really, really interesting. And some of the depictions and they actually, the name is Rata, but it's not spelled the same. And there's some depictions I've seen of, I can't think of the name of her partner. It wasn't Adamson, but they show him riding on a big bird together and stuff. It's interesting.
Really?
It's interesting to see. Huh. Yeah. I've seen some remarkable imagery based on that.
Yeah, those stories of the passenger birds in mythology are quite remarkable. Or, you know, birds picking up human beings for other reasons and that kind of thing.
Little remnants of legends finding their way into the tradition and getting lodged, and they're sort of disconnected from anything else in a certain sense, but it's intriguing.
Yeah.
It's actually in the same paper, 77, where they talk about the tablets on the dusty shelves. They contain a lot of these records, which is a very intriguing comment.
The tablets on the dusty shelves, wow.
Yeah. And these tablets, descriptive of Dilmun, the paradise of men and God, are now silently resting on the dusty shelves of many museums.
Wow. Just waiting to be discovered and compared. Yeah, it's fascinating to me. Because I knew of I didn't know him personally, but I attended a study group where a priest had attended prior to my getting there. This was, Andre might remember, when Roxanne and Jim had a study group in Arvada. So I was attending that in 1984 and 85, and they told me the story of a priest that came and attended study group for a while that was a gifted linguist and specialized in ancient languages. And that he had been privileged to study at the Vatican and to look at the archives. And in the ancient documents, he found much of what the Urantia book tells us. And he actually left the priesthood because he became so discouraged by the fact that this information has been hidden from humanity, that it was there. And he became discouraged because he thought, you know, look at the trouble that our angelic friends and our planetary caretakers had to go to give us back what we already had, because humans have so selfishly guarded it and won't share it.
Yeah.
And he actually left the priesthood.
The notion that people aren't ready for it or wouldn't know what to do with it or that kind of thing, which may have been true for centuries, certainly would have been true when the educated class were, you know, day and night above their brethren. But there's no excuse for it today. And in fact, you know, it's a reprehensible aspect of institutional religion and Roman Catholicism that so many things are hidden from the people.
So many things
are
hidden.
I don't know. I mean, they had such garbled and piecemeal descriptions of these things. I mean, it didn't have to be sort of, you know, malevolent in its motivation. Maybe they just thought it was these remnants of legends just really wouldn't help people and would more confuse them. And I mean, it's really disjointed, I would imagine, what they have. And they say that one of the purposes of Revelation is to take all of that confusing remnant material and put it and present it in a coherent history that really makes sense of what our whole planetary trajectory has been. So you know,
the Ranch book does that.
Yeah, and without that, these things, they might just be looked at as distortions or confusions, and they just didn't think they would be helpful, maybe, you know, to common people. Who knows? Yeah.
And maybe the Urantia book helps make them more sense, give them more sense. And I think of, you know, Robert Sarmast's work that he originally did with the Sumerian texts and how he compared them to the Urantia book. And I'll never forget what he said. I attended a workshop that he did, and he said, when you look at what the Sumerians were writing about their god and goddess, which is Adam and Eve, if you compare the two, it's just so clear, he said. And the beautiful thing about having the Sumerian texts is that we can see how they grieved the loss of their god and goddess. He said you actually feel their grief. It's in their words. And they grieved for centuries, you know. And so it'll be a wonderful feature going forward that we might be able to do comparisons on these ancient writings and have the Urantia book as a guide to help us understand what's being said in them and what they're talking about. And we know that he took, the teachings of Atlantis and compared them to the garden as well, and it lined up so well. Again, a lot of our legends, which seem to be mythology, are clarified in the Urantia book. So that's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But do we want to read maybe a little more of this section, or?
Yeah, well, I can keep going, or someone else can pick up if you want. We're on, you want me to keep going?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay,
sure.
All right. So we're on paragraph 6.
I think 5.
Was it 5? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No, I said neither of these groups, but I'll read it again. Neither of these groups is an evolutionary accident. Both are essential features in the predetermined plans of the universe architects, and their appearance on the evolving worlds at the opportune juncture is in accordance with the original designs and developmental plans of the supervising life carriers. Primary midwayers are energized intellectually and spiritually by the angelic technique and are uniform in intellectual status. the seven adjutant mind spirits make no contact with them. And only the sixth and seventh, the spirit of worship and the spirit of wisdom, are able to minister to the secondary group. Secondary midwayers are physically energized by the Adamic technique, spiritually encircuited by the seraphic, and intellectually endowed with the Marantia transition type of mind. They are divided into four physical types, seven orders spiritually, and 12 levels of intellectual response to the joint ministry of the last two adjutant spirits and the Marantia mind. These diversities determine their differential of activity and of planetary assignment. Primary midwayers resemble angels more than mortals. The secondary orders are much more like human beings. Each renders invaluable assistance to the other in the execution of their manifold planetary assignments. The primary ministers can achieve liaison cooperation with both Marantia and spirit energy controllers and mind circuiters. The secondary group can establish working connections only with the physical controllers and the material circuit manipulators. But since each order of midwayer can establish perfect synchrony of contact with the other, either group is thereby able to achieve practical utilization of the entire energy gamut, extending from the gross physical power of the material worlds up through the transition phases of universe energies to the higher spirit reality forces of the celestial realms. The gap between the material and spiritual worlds is perfectly bridged by the serial association of mortal man, secondary midwayer, primary midwayer, Marantia cherubim, mid-phase cherubim, and seraphim. In the personal experience of an individual mortal, these diverse levels are undoubtedly more or less unified and made personally meaningful by the observed and mysterious operations of the Divine Thought Adjuster. On normal worlds, you want to stop there? We can stop there.
No, it just said by the unobserved and mysterious.
Oh, did I say observed? But meaningful by the unobserved. Okay, thank you. And
well, maybe you
mysterious.
Observe them, Paula, but we don't.
Oh, if only.
Yeah, you're.
I think I might have caught a glimpse of one out the corner of my eye once or twice.
Yeah, Paul, you may be a midwayer, Paula.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I think. Okay, I'll keep going. On normal worlds, the primary midwayers maintain their service as the intelligence corps, and as celestial entertainers on behalf of the planetary prince, while the secondary midwayers continue their cooperation with the Adamic regime on furthering the cause of progressive planetary civilization. In case of the defection of the planetary prince and the failure of the material sun, as occurred on Urantia, the midway creatures become the wards of the system sovereign and serve under the directing guidance of the acting custodian of the planet. But on only three other worlds in Satania do these beings function as one group under unified leadership, as do the United Midway Ministers of Urantia. The planetary work of both primary and secondary midwayers is varied and diverse on the numerous individual worlds of a universe. But on the normal and average planets, their activities are very different from the duties which occupy their time on isolated spheres such as Urantia. The primary midwayers are the planetary historians who, from the time of the arrival of the planetary prince to the age of settled light and life, formulate the pageants and design the portrayals of planetary history for the exhibits of the planets on the system headquarters world. Midwayers remain for long periods on an inhabited world, but if faithful to their trust, they will eventually and most certainly be recognized for their age-long service in maintaining the sovereignty of the Creator Sun. They will be duly rewarded for their patient ministry to the material mortals on their world of time and space. Sooner or later, all accredited midway creatures will be mustered into the ranks of the ascending sons of God and will be duly initiated into the long adventure of the paradise ascent in company with those very mortals of animal origin, their earth brethren, whom they so jealously guarded and so effectively served during the long planetary sojourn. And this paper was presented by A. Melchizedek, acting by request of the chief of the seraphic hosts of Nevadon.
Mm.
Well,
wow.
Wow. There's a lot, so much in there.
A lot there. I know.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
The difference in how they're energized and their use of the adjutant spirits or not, I think, is really interesting, particularly the secondary midwares, who apparently have the last two adjutants of wisdom and worship and wisdom, but they also have Mirage mm-hmm. mind. That's
yeah. Well, they're not.
But then the primaries don't have adjutant mind. Yeah, they have. And they talk about these techniques of energizing. You know, be energized intellectually and spiritually by the angelic technique. That'd be the primary midwares, and then secondary are physically energized by the Adamic technique. So, I don't know, interesting to even get any kind of understanding of what they're talking about there.
Yeah, it's hard hold on to it because I think our understanding of those terms and what they mean by those terms is really pretty meager at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they're giving us an introduction to maybe what we may more thoroughly understand up higher.
Yeah.
One thing, by the way, that caught me was in the second last paragraph where they say that the primary midwares are the planetary historians, and it just occurred to me that maybe one of the reasons why they play such a huge role in the depiction of Part 4 and the life and teachings of Jesus is because that's, in a sense, that's part of their function, is to be the recorders and the depictors of everything that happened in his bestowal on one level,
mm-hmm.
as historians, yeah.
And why they're so mm-hmm. masterful at it.
Yeah.
Why the writing is just so amazing
uh-huh.
and beautiful. What a gift Part 4 is to us from them. I love to think about how much joy they had in writing it. And how much joy they have in humans even knowing they exist, you know? Because prior to the Urantia book, we had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
So here they have been mm-hmm. working all of these millennia, you know, and being isolated like us, you know? They're cut
yeah.
off too, just like we are. And I wonder when they start ascending, you know, will they be at light and life level? They just skip Mansonia, right? They'll ascend from a much higher level than we would.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah, it's a good question as to where they begin their progression.
Right.
And what they would have to do to go through it all. But even if they started at Salvington, they might also like light and lifers, be sent back to act as teachers down at the lower levels.
Well, except that they would have had hundreds of thousands of years of experience really at every level. So it's not
right,
like they would need to go back and supplement. What an amazing base that would be to start off with is, you know, several hundred thousand years of seeing planetary development and participating in it and aiding in it. That's pretty remarkable in and of itself.
And that's their specialty, right? I mean, I was struck by that the primaries are entertainers.
that made me chuckle.
Kind of they entertain the seraphim. I mean, what do you think they mean by that? Are they literally? And that the secondaries are the, you know, planetary civilization. That's their job. That's where they, you know, that's where they excel. But the primaries are entertainers? That was striking to me. I think they must mean
something much more enhanced than what we think of by entertainment. You know, given that they're historians, you know, I would think of documentaries and that kind of entertainment, you know, educational and uplifting entertainment but who knows? I mean, it is intriguing, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, and they're also the intelligence corps. They say that. They keep an eye on the super material sphere, dimensions of the planet.
Celestial entertainers.
Yeah.
It's in paragraph 10 where they say on normal worlds, the primary midwayers maintain their service as the intelligence corps and as celestial entertainers in behalf of the planetary prince, while the secondary ministers continue their cooperation with the Adamic regime of furthering the cause of planetary civilization. So I guess there, you know, you could, and that's on normal worlds. What are they on our world? You know,
yeah, very different on our world. What they're saying.
Yeah. They're probably all engaged in planetary civilization, I would think. But we know that they communicate with the primaries communicate with the celestial realm. And so it could just be entertainers, meaning, you know, hosts. When they come, they make sure they have all they need. And
well, I think it probably goes beyond that. When they say entertainers, I think they mean entertainers. I'm sure they've got a great sense of humor. And I'd love to
speculate about that.
Not that they don't do all these other more serious things as well, but
yeah, right.
I don't know.
That's intriguing to me. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there must be a much higher sense of what it means to be entertaining.
An entertainer, right?
Yeah,
right.
than what we think of.
But, you know, they tell us about the celestial artisans and the reversion directors, and, you know, how humor is an important part of our evolving nature all the way along. And they say the angels share our sense of humor. So I would imagine the midwayers do too. But I've got a question for you. I don't know why I've never focused on this before exactly. But, you know, in paper 121, Times of Michael's Bestowal, where they're sort of introducing the Jesus papers. And at the end of that paper, there's an acknowledgement, which is a sort of several paragraph statement by the lead midwayer on this project, and describing about the sources he draws upon and the rules that were involved in that and so forth. Is that a secondary midwayer or a primary midwayer making that statement? I don't know. I just scanned it over and it doesn't seem to say exactly.
My assumption was always that it was the secondaries that were the authors part four, but...
Yeah, me too, and I don't know why, where I got that idea, but just because they're closest to us, I guess, it would seem like they would be the ones to be in the
position.
Well,
I think
there's
something said in one of the preambles.
Mm. Yeah, maybe so. Anyway,
I'll look.
About the authors.
I had to cooperate. Yeah, I'll try to.
Yeah, because, you know, like the other papers in the book, they don't end each paper with a sign-off from the midwives. They just tell you up front that they wrote it. And so each paper, there's no, you know, author accreditation, you know.
No, because it really is coming from the commission.
Right, right.
You know, as signed off by the Melchizedek supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what they indicate. I'll try to find that here.
Okay, thanks, Andre. Perry on the board asks an intriguing question. She says, I often think that the book came to us at the urging of the midwayers. And I tend to agree with that, Perry. She said, how long before it started coming through do you think the book was begun? I think that's an interesting question, and a lot of readers speculate about that. I've heard, you know, mid-1800s. I've heard before that, for 300 years before, you know. I wonder what you guys think about.
A lot of apocryphal stuff, yeah. And Chuck was musing about that on one of the boards. And we were looking at that and saying, you know, there's all kinds of apocryphal stuff that say that this was first talked about in the planetary government around the Middle Ages, you know, the Dark Ages even, that there was thought about how they might try to work toward the next revelation. And you can imagine that certain ones would be doing that. So that's not an unusual thought, really, in a way. But it's really more the mechanics and what they were going to do and how they would do it. Because you can imagine they could hardly imagine how they could have done this in the year, you know, 1000 or 1100. You know, that's not something that was even, what would they say? They couldn't have talked about evolution. They couldn't have talked about the supreme or any of that. So they had to be anticipating what kinds of evolution of human thought and culture might be occurring and how that might transpire and how to bring that about as part of preparing for this revelation to come through.
Yeah, I remember.
Most humans weren't even literate.
Yeah, Merritt Horn makes the wonderful point in one of his, in a course that he does on, you know, the revelation. I always forget, we used to call it study methods, but it's got a better title now. And, you know, one of the points he makes out is that the word evolution, pre-1837 or something like that, only meant to unfurl a sail. That's what evolution meant. Okay, it didn't have the whole unfurling of that occurs in growth, like you might see for fern leaves unfurling or anything like that, and didn't take on the larger meaning of evolution until that was popularized by Charles Darwin, but and maybe by others before him, but in the early 19th century, that's all it meant. Was to unfurl a sail. But you can't talk about evolution without a concept, without a word that you could have talked about growth. But
talk about patience. Talk about the patience they have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I was just gonna add that John Coslin, you all remember him, I'm sure, used to say something similar about astronomical discoveries that awaited the design and building of powerful telescopes, which was just happening around the time of the revelation or shortly before, and that was another just sort of bedrock conceptual piece that had to be in place before they could even begin to talk about the cosmos. You know, they had to have some idea, you know, about nebulas and galaxies and that there's a lot going on out there and it's a big universe before they could even begin to talk about that. So.
And Patrick Yesh loved to point out, and did on the show, in fact, that he didn't think they would have been able to give us these teachings without an understanding of psychology.
Right.
And, you know, the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting how they waited. Yeah. They certainly, you know, Perry says perhaps it was in response to Michael's injunction to bring his world up to speed in coordination with will and evolution. And, you know, probably the plans for it somehow, I mean, obviously we know we get epical revelations. They know we do. They're the ones that bring them. And so they were probably planning for it for a long time. It wouldn't surprise me at all. And waiting patiently, you know?
Yeah,
waiting,
you know,
patiently.
In relation to the word evolution, another term in a whole broad constellation of concepts is relation, is the term personality. That in the late 1800s and through the 1900s, the whole realm of psychology, like you were saying, Paula, you know, personality is such a central concept to the revelation, and it only really began to flower in the 18 and 1900s as a concept in the culture.
Not to mention literacy, which I kind of squeaked in there a minute ago, but even just that, even just 100 years ago or 150 years ago, not that many people could read. You know, and we've made tremendous progress in that regard in just 100 years in terms of education. So we really are on the march. You know, when the Urantia book tells us we're on the march to an unrevealed planetary destiny, we really are.
Mm-hmm.
We're on the march.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, with this book. It's like they wanted to present it as soon as they could, but not too soon, because they needed certain things to be in place. But if you consider just what's happened, you know, in the last, say, 100 years, if they were to do it now, they would have so much more to work with, you know, just conceptually, you know, like with our evolutions in technology and the cloud and invisible lines of communication and all of that kind of thing that we just now take for granted that didn't exist at the time they wrote the book. You know, or, you know, the whole, like, digital retrieval of information and the Internet and all of that. Those would have provided powerful metaphors and descriptive concept models for much of what they try to explain to us in the book as it is. You know, pretty much the word circuit is the only word they have, so it shows up hundreds of times in the book. But, you know, so finding that sweet spot in the evolving state of affairs on the planet, you know, where they could not do it too soon, but as soon as possible, right? Just finding that opportune moment where there's enough to work with that they could get this thing going, knowing that if they waited longer, there might be more to work with, but the urgency, there's a certain amount of urgency, I think, also factoring into the presentation of this revelation,
right?
Just the need for it. And they also wanted to catch us at a time when we still had real thinkers. You know, people who could write complete sentences, have arcs of thought, and things like that.
Speaking of language and being able to write, right, and read.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Or, you know, appreciation of the written word.
Yeah. Which seems to be waning. I don't know about you guys, how you feel about that, but, you know, being someone who has exhibited this book to many people, something this big and this dense is very as a tough. It gets to be a harder sell, not an easier one, you know, because people don't read much anymore. Have you noticed that? I mean, and that's interesting to even say that, because then maybe they do. You know, why is everybody writing a book? Everybody's writing a book.
Oh, I know.
And and books are selling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I don't know, but it's interesting how, you know, we boil everything down to a soundbite these days, and and how much of the concepts of the Urantia book, you just can't do that. You can't boil it down to a soundbite. So it's interesting.
The mental patience to, like, actually read a long paragraph.
We're in a phase. Do you think it's a phase?
I think it is. I think for one thing, we're going to learn to educate ourselves better. It's going to take a little bit. We're going to have to see the result of having not educated ourselves very well these last two generations.
Wow.
And not made that a value that is held by more than, you know, what I would call a minority. The idea of continuing with education for more than just bettering your economic development, that's now, I think, a minority of people. It may be still a large minority, but it's a minority of people that think that way. And as a result of that, we have people that are subject to all kinds of misinformation. And that's creating a lot of the polarity that we see in our society right now, and that itself is a destructive force in society. We are meant to move toward greater and greater integration and greater cooperation with each other, not greater and greater opposition and greater entrenchment in camps. And to the extent that we do that, to that extent, we potentially undermine not only the cultural foundation of our civilization, which is all important, it's the most important thing, but people don't realize that the material foundation also sits on that cultural foundation. And it's too easy to destroy that by moving into things like wars and even civil war and that kind of thing. And I don't even, these days you don't have to be looking at war as having to be a violent proposition that is just physical. You know, we're beginning to see more and more the kinds of wars that are talked about in the Lucifer Rebellion. That was a war of ideas and ideals. Yeah, it was a war of ideas and ideals. And that was regarded as war. It's portrayed as war. And we're seeing that
war in heaven
in our society.
Yeah.
It's just as destructive. Mm-hmm. The only way through that is for people to be educated to the point where they can see others' points of view, where they can appreciate others' points of view and be willing to say, you know, I don't think that that's true, but I see where you're coming from. And when we can't do that anymore, that is an undermining feature of our society, and it allows the vicious minorities talked about in the papers on government, you know, in paper 70 and other papers, paper 81 and whatnot, that talk about how, you know, representative government can be undermined. And we need to be aware of that.
Yeah, well, and also I think there's one antidote for what ails us in general, and that's love. It's just love.
Yeah.
Love, patience, willingness to understand, willingness to embrace the other person's point of view and let them, you know, and I just can't, whenever I think of what can be done to bring us together, the only word that ever comes to me is just love, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the problems with rebellion. There's nothing lovable about rebellion.
No.
It's a severing of the love relationship with the Father. You know, it's a tenet of the Lucifer Manifesto. So once you've done that, you're not motivated by love anymore. You've got other motives going on. They're more about, you know, personal gain. More selfish types of power, you know, all of that stuff, a little constellation of other priorities take precedence. As we could see in the unfolding, what we know of the unfolding of the rebellion, it was not about love. I mean, those who oppose the rebellion, like you're saying, are motivated by love. And they have a living relationship with the Creator. and it's a completely different stance, completely different orientation of the personality. And that those who are motivated in that way, who are trying to create a civilization based on love, they have to protect them. They have to protect that from those who aren't. Just, you know, I don't know. It's a, kind of a sobering, you know, in that section where they talk about the golden rulers, you know, how they have to protect their superior civilization somehow, some way. So those are all issues that are kind of coming into focus, maybe more intensely than they ever have. I'm not sure. I guess it's always been that way, but still. But yeah, love is the banner to hold high, that's for sure. But not everyone is going to do that because of this being a rebellion planet.
Yeah, so, there you go.
And it's, I don't
no
know.
Doubt what,
it's kind of a,
what,
harsh reality.
Yeah, it's a harsh reality for sure.
By the way, on a on the note of the question about the Midware Commission that you had asked before,
oh, yeah.
You know, a lot of that's talked about in the end of paper 121, but I think it deserves looking at some of the other acknowledgments. But it's clear that the secondary midware of the Apostle Andrew is a member of that commission with 11 associate fellow midwares. I do not see where they indicate that they are exclusively secondary midwares. On the contrary, there's the reference to the Brotherhood of the United Midwares of Urantia. So you can imagine that probably, most likely being an equally represented commission, though we don't know that for sure. We don't know how many of each kind of midware there might be on that on that council. So, you know, but we know that there's at least one secondary midware, and it's probably likely that it was a mixed group by virtue of referring to the Brotherhood of the United Midwares of Urantia.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, thanks for digging that out.
Along with the supervision of a Melchizedek, so.
Right. I've got another kind of related question. I don't know. This paragraph in the material we just read, the second to last paragraph where they talk about the primary midwares, the planetary historians, and they say from the time of the arrival of the planetary prince to the age of settled light and life, that these primary midwares formulate the pageants and design the portrayals of planetary history for the exhibits of the planets on the system headquarters worlds. And I'm wondering if they're permanent residents, or at least permanent up to a certain point, of this planet. I mean, the residents of this planet during that whole period they're talking about, from the prince to light and life, how would they be able to function as designers of these pageants and portrayals on the system headquarters worlds?
Well,
you can still plan something
and have that plan, you know, be
shared away.
You know, go up with. Yeah, right.
They upload it. Yeah. That's what I was going to say. They upload
it. Yeah,
they upload it. Absolutely. They've got microchips.
Knowing what I know of designers, they're going to want to be there to make sure it gets done right.
Yeah.
I don't know.
We can't imagine.
I mean, it would have to be,
you know, how
it would have
how
to be
superior
something.
Technology is that can utilize material, mindal, spiritual, morontial, any of those means, and what they can transmit that way.
But that sounds like a big amount of work, I mean, doing that, formulating the pageants and designing portrayals. I mean, that would be, it sounds like a full-time job. So I was just wondering how they manage their time to be able to do that and take care of business on this.
Yeah, that's what I wonder, too.
Yeah.
They don't manage it the way
or
I manage my time, I can tell you that.
Yeah, I think we could all say that.
Well, they have an innate sense of they do triage well. Let's just say that they know where to focus their attention, where it'll do the most good.
Yeah.
I think,
or maybe they have a committee. Maybe there's a
Yeah.
smaller group of them. that do that.
You know, this talk of the United Midwares, I just searched that term, and, of course, Paper 77, Section 8 is the United Midwares. That's a section on the United Midwares. And the first paragraph of that section says, at the last adjudication of this world, when Michael removed the slumbering survivors of time, the midway creatures were left behind, left to assist in spiritual and semi-spiritual work of the planet. They now function as a single core, embracing both orders and numbering 10,992. The United Midwares of Urantia are at present governed alternately by the senior member of each order. This regime has obtained since their amalgamation into one group shortly after Pentecost. And I love their motto, what the United Midwares undertake, the United Midwares do. And a good friend, you guys know, Chris Riggio, came up with the human equivalent, the humans of Urantia. What we do, what we set out to do, we do do.
Yes.
Oh, I love that one. What we set out to do, we do do. But yeah, that's an interesting little study there. Just United Midwares, and a lot came up. Seven different references came up. And also in that same search, it says all orders of angelic hosts regard him as their coordinated director, while the United Midwares, since the departure of, they're talking about the resident governor general, by the way, they say since the departure of 1-2-3 the first, who went to join the 24 counselors. So 1-2-3 the first got to get off the planet, which is an interesting distinction. He got to go serve on the Council of 420.
Another.
In reality, we have 10,991 that are left on the planet with him.
Yeah, because he left, right?
I was just going to point out another interesting thing that came up in our reading today. It was in paragraph 7, talking about the secondary midwares, how they're divided into all these different types. You know, I tend to forget about that. But this says they're divided into 4 physical types, 7 orders spiritually, and 12 levels of intellectual response to the joint ministry of the last 2 adjutant spirits of the Urantia mind. And then these diversities determine their differential activity in planetary assignment. So that's a little detail that, you know, I mean, I'm sort of aware of it, but curious how that shakes out. I mean, it's interesting because they don't say the equivalent for the primary midwares. It sounds like the primary midwares are all more or less the same, whereas the secondary midwares have this tremendous variation among them, which apparently allows them to serve in lots of different ways. But like 4 physical types, you know, what would that be about? You know, maybe some are more capable of interacting with physical reality than others, perhaps, or can even
that's
make themselves
way
invisible.
I would. Yeah, that's the way I would take that.
And then these 12
talk about
levels,
diverse.
Yeah. 7 orders spiritually, 12 levels of intellectual response. And how they put this, to the joint ministry of the last 2 adjutants and Urantia mind. So they have this joint mind ministry. They get the last 2 adjutants, but then they also have Urantia mind. And, you know, they talk about how even we, as mortals, if we master all 7 psychic circles, we can receive this, forget the exact word they use, like superimposition of Urantia mind. So we can achieve something similar to that, apparently, if we can make it to those levels of development, which would draw us even closer to the secondary midwares in some sense, I would assume.
Right.
So, you know,
yeah, their description.
Yeah. And also running through this, and things I, something else I often wonder about is how all this is then coordinated with the Master Seraphim. You know, the 12 groups of Master Seraphim are actually sort of tasked, they have the responsibility of overseeing those 12 different aspects of our evolving, of the planet's evolution. So I assume the Midwares work very closely with them.
Well, you know, they keep talking about their planetary responsibilities, and it boggles my imagination to even think about what they have to do. You know, when I think about
them.
There's not very many of them.
Right, right.
And they are so intricate, too, in much of the liaison work between the spirit realm and us, right? So they tell us that they couldn't possibly have brought this book through at all without them.
Right.
Because they were key.
Yeah, it's the secondary midwares, some of whom, can make that deep dive into a human mind and contact the adjuster of that human. And they're saying that that's the method by which this revelation was, you know, able to be communicated. Like they used the adjuster of this individual as kind of
like
their
essential
arena where it took place. You know, all the meetings with the authors coming all the way from the center of reality, some of them, you know, the highest levels being paradise origin beings, and the translations that had to take place, and all of that, a huge, huge project. It required tremendous coordination and communication. But the secondary midwares provide that final link down to the human level to where all this content can be put into the English language and presented, you know, presumably in handwritten form from the stories we know. But
yeah, they're just so essential, it seems to me. It's remarkable what they do. You know, being the historians, the resident historians, the resident custodians, you know. I used to love to tell people, and, you know, in the New Age, there's this term, the Akashic Records. Well, I think what they're tapping into is the fact that the midwares have recorded history for us. It's there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's not lost. And we tend to think that it is lost, but it's not. And that in itself is a revelation. History's not lost, and it can be given back to us. And I always love to think how historically they'll view us, how they'll view the time that we lived in, the 60s. You know, I would love to see their critique or their assessment of the time we've lived in, the 20th century. And especially certain decades, you know, and certain pivotal moments, you can look back and say, wow, something happened right there. Something, you know, amazing. I really can't wait to see their assessment of what happened, you know, where we were and how, you know, how they perceived it. And in their view, where the progress, where the potential was. I'm just that's extraordinary to me to be able to see, you know, what they think.
Well, and so many other periods of history as well, you know, pivotal times.
Exactly.
And that's to me what sounds so interesting about the Mansion World teachers, you know, who are abandoned, so they say, when the mortals they're, you know, that they're working with through the seraphim of that mortal, then they're left on the Mansion World as teachers. But they came from all these different times in our history, you know, the ones that came from Urantia. So they'll be intimately familiar with so many different periods of history that, you know, we only have a very sketchy understanding of. But they were right in the middle of it, you know, in terms of being ministers to humans during that period, when that individual happened to leave Urantia. You know, could have been in the 1700s, could have been in the 1200s, who knows. But they'll have a complete understanding of that particular time. So those cherubim and seraphim who are left to function as mansion world teachers will also be filling in our understanding of history when we get to the mansion world, I'm sure. It's just going to be
Think
so
of all the stories of unsung heroes.
Yes, so what is really up with Genghis Khan? What can you tell us about him? Things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You know, I think of her story as well as his story, right?
Uh-huh.
And
sure.
And all of those stories that have never been told on the planet. You know, they give us a couple of snippets of remarkable humans who have done remarkable things. Imagine the stories that we'll yet discover. About
And the ones
humans
that the women we're doing that we don't learn about maybe so much from our history books that were crucial, you know. In terms of, you know, maybe the men are more visible in what they're doing, but there's usually a woman behind them or beside them or around them, you know.
Right.
Having tremendous influence.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just amazing to think about, you know, when you think about history and you think, I'm always fascinated with historians. I love to hear them talk, you know. And they just talk about, you know, like there's historians that just specialize in nothing but presidential history or, you know, various aspects of human life. And it's fascinating, the story that doesn't get told. And then you have remarkable storytellers like Steven Spielberg who will get a story like about Schindler and tell the story of how this one man, what this one man did.
Mm-hmm.
And you never heard that story before, and it's fascinating to me that all of a sudden this comes to life, and they hold that. These midwayers hold all of that for us. They hold that history among all the other things they do. What remarkable creatures. So in love with them. You know, they didn't have to do anything but write the Jesus Papers to be my heroes, but...
Mm-hmm.
Imagine all that they do. It's just extraordinary. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really unimaginable. You know, when I think of just like a movie like Groundhog Day, where you see, you know, Bill Murray having learned enough about what's going on in his town to be at the right place in the right time, to be able to do all of that, in order for a group of less than 11,000 beings to be doing what they do, and only, you know, just slightly over 1,000 of them being the secondary midwares and being able to engage with material reality. I mean, they're not getting in the way and making sure that everything goes well or that kind of thing in the same way as that movie. But I think about the idea of the coordination of time that Bill Murray figures out in that film, right, in Groundhog Day, in order to be at just the right place, the right time, and keeps learning things so that each day is a better day that he's reliving. Well, I think of them being able to do that in real time, that they are able to anticipate the best use of their time, plus they've got so many wise beings around them helping to direct them, that must be some of what they're doing. But I try to imagine how they are doing all of that and having the ability to recharge and, you know, have another life or what's important to them. It's really beyond a lot of our ability to imagine how service-motivated the well-motivated are. And what they're actually doing, especially in contrast to their, you know, their rebel associates. They see what happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
So they are tried and true, and they understand the value of service. To me, that's just a remarkable feature of what that united core is and why they probably decided to function as a united core they're as different from each mm-hmm. other, the primaries and secondaries, as they are from us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have very little in common with us. They have a little bit, but my goodness, you know, we're here for 100 years if we're lucky. The youngest of them have been here for 38,000 years. My goodness.
They are. Well, they are experts on us.
The timing of when they united being after Pentecost, I think is interesting mm-hmm. because that's when the mm-hmm. that's when the rebel midwares were removed from the planet.
Good point.
Mm-hmm.
So they could finally not be distracted by their cousins or whatever and get down mm-hmm. to business.
Right. Talk about misinformation and disinformation and them having to battle, you know, that war we were talking about, that war of ideas. And they're on the loyal side and the other ones were on the disloyal side. And maybe,
well, someone,
you know,
pointed out that in Plutarch, you know, Plutarch, the historian, mentioned that the oracles fell silent after Pentecost.
The oracles fell silent. Derek told me that once, and I thought, damn, that's true. That's
so
amazing
to
think
an
about.
Idea what, of what the rebel midwares might have been up to.
Yeah. Well, yeah, here's these humans almost worshiping them, right?
Right, right, getting all mm-hmm. their fortunes for the day from these oracles, you know, leading them off into crazy directions.
Right, right.
That didn't necessarily serve the best interest of the planet.
Maybe that's a preview of coming attractions for humanity, that a lot of the distraction will be gone at some point and the static will clear. The air will clear and we'll be able to see and unite.
Yeah.
Just the way they
were
able to.
Well, that'll be a day.
Yeah, that'll be a great day. I look forward to that. I won't be here, I'm sure, but, you know,
no,
I think we can we can celebrate it from afar. I plan to celebrate every bit of progress your rancho makes, no matter where I am.
We're talking about the material comfort era. It's like we're in the online distraction era.
Ain't that the truth? What a wonderful conversation, you guys. This has been a great paper to study, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And so appreciate you, Marvin,
likewise.
In case you guys wondered, had to drop off. I want to share Bob's comment on the board. He says, in the Midway or Library of Congress, there are probably books that were lost in the fire at Alexandria, and I do believe that's true. Probably every notable thing that any human has ever done somehow, so.
Mm-hmm.
That's
of course
good
they
news.
Have.
Yeah, of course they have.
They just weren't around for Onagar, so we wonder what they might have recapitulated and whether or not there has been any kind of digging around to be able to preserve some of that. You know, there may be some midway archaeology that occurs, you know?
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
Or has already
Wouldn't
occurred.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Well, what a blessing to study about. Yeah, they have it all. And the angels do too. And let's thank the mother for her great gift to us. Wow. I'm so appreciative of it. And thank you. I'm appreciative of you guys too. What an honor to look at 2023.
Yeah, it's always fun studying together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be back, friends.
Looking forward to the next.
Yeah.
Next time, we're going to launch into paper one, I think. Isn't that the plan?
Do you want to launch into paper one next time? I think
that's the plan.
That's the order,
the
marching order.
That'll be something.
So, thanks, everyone on the board, Bob, Perry, Gina. Love you guys. Always good to see you. Thanks, Bond, for listening in, as always. And for everyone who will listen on the archive, we really appreciate you. Love to get your comments always, so. Until next week, I guess we'll just say bye for now.
All right.
Yes. Bye for now, everybody.
Week. Bye for now.
Love you all. Bye-bye.
Love you too. Bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.